Spotify.
Good morning, Portland, Maine, and everyone. And you're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLLB. How are we doing today there, Silly?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
Never been happier.
Good.
It is Saturday, January 30th. You know, we've had a relatively mild winter, but we're only a couple of days away from February.
We are. Coming up quick.
28 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get through February, March, there's definitely snow periodically,
mm-hmm.
but March just feels warmer.
You think so?
Well, I mean, it is warmer, but it just, when you get to March, you can kind of envision going outside and going for a walk or playing Frisbee. And then you get to April, and then the flowers are back.
And the t-shirts come on, and the shorts.
Yep. So we're close here in Maine, kind of getting out of winter, but we have an interesting show today. In just a couple of minutes, we will have Heather Davis, the executive director of The Telling Room. Really an interesting program here, based in Portland, but serves people from all over Maine. And it's a youth program focused on writing and also literacy and communication skills. And we had a really interesting talk with her. In fact, she and one of the participants, one of the students that are part of the writing room, a short while ago, had a chance to visit the White House and meet First Lady Michelle Obama. So you'll hear about that in just about 3 or 4 minutes. And what do we have going for on this day? Let's see what we get here. On this day, January 30th, well, we have the Lone Ranger debuted in 1933. I'm not sure how many of our listeners were listening to that, but wow.
Are you a Lone Ranger fan as a child?
I'm still a Lone Ranger fan. And the Lone Ranger was about, you know, hope. The Lone Ranger was a good guy.
Yeah.
Lone Ranger had the white hat. It was actually founded by a Detroit radio station owner. And the thing that's interesting about the Lone Ranger is it started as a radio program,
mm-hmm.
and it basically made the transition from radio to TV to movies. The other thing that's kind of interesting, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our 32nd U.S. president, only president in history to be elected 4 times, this would have been his birthday in 1882. He is generally considered by historians one of the top three, along with, I think, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, as having the most positive impact. Have you been watching any of the political debates?
Not yet. I haven't.
I watched yesterday. It almost resembles like a game show. and so you have reality star Donald Trump being endorsed by reality star Grizzly Mom Sarah Palin. You have Ted Cruz, who always looks like he's angry. Marco Rubio typically looks like he's just got invited to the adult table and he's kind of pushing hard. Jeb Bush, he almost feels frustrated, like he expected to be the presidential nominee and now, you know, his dad promised him, his brother did. Carly Fiorina, she always seems angry. She just has a look on her face. You know, I think that's her campaign. That's her.
She's trying to be the tough girl.
And I think she has some reasonable business ideas, but she's never run for or been elected for a single office. She hasn't had much public involvement, and I don't get that. Ben Carson always looks like he's
lost.
Yeah, he was, by all accounts, a wonderful surgeon, but mm-hmm. no real connection to foreign policy or the complexity of government. And Chris Christie, I don't know about Chris Christie.
I honestly forgot he was even running for president.
I know. He's an interesting guy. He's a sharp guy in some ways, but he also he rubs me the wrong way. How about Bernie? Do you feel the burn?
I think I am feeling the burn on this one.
Wow. I've noticed something driving on the highway. You know, here in Maine, we have quite a few people that have Priuses,
mm-hmm.
the hybrid car. And almost every Prius, I don't know if this is his loyal army of supporters, but almost every Prius on the road has a I Feel the Burn bumper sticker. So I think he owns the Prius voter block.
He very well might.
And then we've got Hillary Clinton. The funny thing is, on Monday is when the Iowa caucuses take place.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with what a caucus is?
Only vaguely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I could probably survey people in Maine around the country, and nobody really understands it. There's about 1,680 caucus precincts in Iowa. So it's not like primary voting. It's not where you go to your town hall and fill out. It's literally 1,600 political parties where people get together, they argue, they last about an hour, 2 hours, and then they generally reach consensus on what that particular neighborhood or what that precinct wants to do. And so it's really an interesting process. But the funny thing about it is I think there's only 100,000, 150,000 people that participate in Iowa. And when you listen to all the pundits, everyone is acting as if whoever wins Iowa goes on to be the presumptive nominee.
And why is it Iowa?
They've set up their constitution to go first. And it really is interesting. The makeup of Iowa, it really isn't representative of the overall United States.
Right.
It's very focused on farming, very focused on rural. But somehow Iowa on Monday will play a big role in terms of what happens in presidential politics.
All right.
So with that, why don't we get on to our interview? And again, Heather Davis, Executive Director of the Telling Room. This was recorded yesterday. Thank you for joining us here on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to WLOB 1310. Here's the interview. Good morning. Welcome back to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Speaking about paperback writing and literature and writing, please welcome our guest, Heather Davis. Heather is the Executive Director of the Telling Room, and she's involved with all types of writing and literacy and youth programs. And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I am a struggling writer myself.
Many people are.
I know. I am at the top of the list. The whole colon, semicolon thing, no idea. I flip a coin.
Yeah. We try not to place too much emphasis on that. That's not the most fun part. It comes with time.
The fun part is, I guess, the voice and kind of the creative approach. But yeah, before we get into what's going on at the Telling Room, I was really interested in your visit to the White House with the First Lady, with one of your members or students. But before that, talk a little bit about your background and how you came to Maine as the executive director of the Telling Room. And then we'll talk a little bit about what the Telling Room is and the kind of programs you offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I've always been kind of a bookworm and been a writer as a hobby. And in the early 2000s, I had a chance to start teaching writing in an after-school program in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with it. I was working with teenagers. We were putting out a youth-produced newspaper that went all over Manhattan. And it just felt like a calling, and it was something I wanted to continue to do. So I ended up living in Austin, Texas, and I met a bunch of people who had similar interests, and we decided to start a youth writing center together in Austin. That's called Austin Batcave, and it's still there and doing really well. And then,
but before you move forward, you mentioned you were a bookworm, and then we started talking about writing. Is reading a core function of being an effective writer, and especially how you're teaching and how you're forming these youth groups? And talk a little bit about when you were learning, you know, I don't know if it was in high school or pre-high school, but what you were reading that inspired you to take the inputting of English language and stories and imagination and then going into the output phase, which is writing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I read everything that I could get my hands on. And I learned how to write in college, I think. I think most of my peers and I showed up and didn't have the skills that we needed right away to write as effectively and as at an advanced level as we were expected to in college. So I learned a lot by trial and error, and then ended up becoming a writing assistant towards the end of my college career and helping other people.
What books inspired you that you looked at as examples that were just really effective, not only enjoyable to read, but were great platforms for young people to kind of learn to write from?
Well, The books that I personally love aren't always the books that I use in the classroom with kids.
What, Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing, Ken Kesey? What was the genre that you were most interested in?
I love all of those, actually. In college, I read a lot of Cormac McCarthy, the Border Trilogy, and I was in college in New Mexico, so it was really amazing to read about that landscape that I was in and to be immersed in that story of the relationship between America and Mexico, which was very present. Cormac McCarthy's writing is not something I've ever used with students. I really loved Dave Eggers' writing, which is how I found out about 826 National, which is a group of writing centers that's very similar to The Telling Room. So he started his career with a memoir about raising his younger brother after his parents died within a similar period of time from cancer.
Interesting. What do you think of Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, and his whole kind of German look at existentialism, Buddhism, and all that?
I love the German writers. I love Hesse. I have slightly more affection for the Russian writers. I got really into Tolstoy in college, and actually wrote my final piece of work for graduation on War and Peace.
Most of his stuff, whether it's War and Peace or other things, it's not so much reading as it is taking a large phone book. There's so much volume, so many words, mm-hmm. and such density of language that I don't think I've heard of any young, my wife and I have three kids, and I don't think that is his kind of connected with today's generation, whether it's the approach or the style writing. But I think most teens would look at Tolstoy and look at, I don't know if it has 1,000 pages or 1,000,000,000 pages, but you look at it and you get intimidated and you go, how am I going to go from page 100 to page 1,200? In every sentence and paragraph is dense with, a lot of kind of complex themes and words.
It's intimidating. It is. A lot of contemporary adults are familiar with Anna Karenina because of Oprah. I think it was an Oprah book club choice one year.
Right.
But then the BBC just released a new film version of War and Peace. So maybe more people will be
Oprah's
introduced
done a
to
lot.
It.
Sully, have I ever mentioned when I bumped into Stedman?
I don't think you have.
Are you familiar with the Oprah kind of mythology?
Oh, yes.
So I was traveling, I think, in North Carolina, South Carolina. And I don't want to say anything disparaging about Stedman or the weight of Harpo will come down upon me. But I was at the airport, and Stedman was there with a companion who wasn't Oprah.
Uh-oh. I'm impressed you recognized him. I don't think I would recognize him.
Stedman?
Yeah.
It almost feels like, and I'm a fan of Oprah in both the length of her work and the scope of her work as a businesswoman, as a media personality, and as somebody who's also done significant work relative to charities and communities all around the world. But there's, for some reason, for the last two decades, Stedman has been this one-dimensional character that it feels like Oprah kind of wheels out whenever there's a public event, or she kind of references him in interviews. Like, oh, just the other day I was talking to Stedman. And he's always seemed, I don't want to say cartoonish in a negative way, but just in the dimension of he's not really real.
Yeah. So you think it's a farce? He's like a hired.
I don't want to say that. I don't know what Oprah's deal is, but it's almost Stedman playing the character of Stedman, relative to Oprah's very complex universe, where she's going from South America to Hawaii to California to New York to Paris, and she lives this very dynamic life, and she and Gail, are off doing these great adventures, and then literally in almost kind of this systematic mechanical way, Stedman shows up once a month in a quote.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if they're good friends, if they're buddies, if they, watch movies and have popcorn together or whatever, but there's always the mythology of Stedman is some, I don't even know. So when I saw Stedman in North Carolina with a travel companion. Yeah. And I'm not casting aspersions. I don't know what the deal was, but it was just like, I looked over at him and I'm like, hello, Stedman. Right? I don't even know what his first name is or his last. He's just Stedman.
Yeah, he's just Stedman.
He's just Stedman. It'd be like seeing Madonna. You would just go, hello, Madonna.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, exactly. But, you know, I don't know how that's relevant.
You missed your one chance to clear all this up and ask him what he feels about it.
He seemed happy. You know, and my kind of general philosophy is Stedman seems happy. Oprah seems happy. Who am I to dig deeper and try to reveal some sort of, some sort of underlying myth? They're happy, I'm happy. By the way, we've got Heather Davis here. She is the executive director of The Telling Room. And we were talking about reading, and that's gonna kind of morph into writing. And before we talk about your kind of path, do people read as much anymore? You know, forget about writing. The mechanical process of writing, it used to be literally and figuratively people would write. You know, so mm-hmm. when Shakespeare was being Shakespeare, he wasn't typing, he wasn't using either mechanical typewriters or digital word processing. Mm-hmm. He was writing. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, writing is kind of the figurative term for constructing and organizing language and stories. But before we even get to writing, I have a real concern that the entire scope of how young people are taking in words and information, mm-hmm. and then how they're processing it, mixing it with point of view, creativity, thoughtfulness, and then outputting mm-hmm. stories. But yeah. It starts with, if you can't see things and recognize mm-hmm. how things are organized with words.
Yeah.
And from your experience, both with the Bat Cave, the Telling Room, and your academic experience, you know, St. John's and Santa Fe, and you went to Goddard, are young people reading enough, or is it all 140 characters on Twitter?
I think young people are still reading. I don't think they're writing as much as I would love to see. I think that's a function of what schools are doing or are required to do, what kind of standards they have, what the curriculum is like, and what's mandated. The fact that it's not writing for its own sake isn't always seen as valuable or important. And there are so many modes of communication that don't require thoughtful or more complicated writing. So, short bursts of text in an email or in different formats. So that most kids are probably doing a little bit more of that type of writing than sort of more complicated writing. But I think people are reading. I mean, you look at how many bookstores exist in Portland alone, and the popularity of certain, YA series for kids. Like, kids are reading. I'm not worried about the reading as much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll move on from the reading. Talk a little bit about, in terms of what brought you from Texas as one of the co-founders of the Bat Cave, and then where and how from Austin, Texas, did you find Portland, Maine?
So I had a daughter. My husband and I had a daughter in 2007, and we'd only been living in Texas for a few years. And so it was just a very personal decision. We had to think about, do we want to raise our family here, 2,000 miles away from all of our family who live back on the East Coast, or do we want to move? And we decided that we wanted to move. And so we were looking for a town that was urban but not too big, that was, close to our family within a day's drive or a couple hours drive of everybody. And we visited Portland for 2 days in June, and it was beautiful. And we just thought, sure, we can, this Portland seems great. Let's do it.
So if the visit happened in January, February,
I might have had second thoughts.
the story may have evolved differently.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was almost random. I mean, you kind of wanted a city a certain size. Mm-hmm. You wanted proximity to family, but there was nothing. You had no real roots or connection to Portland before visiting?
Honestly, no. I mean, I had vacationed in Bar Harbor as a child. I knew Maine. I knew it was beautiful.
Right.
And we had family in Maine that we'd visited before, and in New Hampshire and Vermont and in upstate New York. So I had a I definitely had a connection to New England and to the East Coast.
Interesting.
But I had never spent any time here before. Yeah.
Well, talk a little bit as the executive director of the Telling Room. Why don't you talk about what the Telling Room is?
Yeah.
There's been quite a bit of press over the last month about one of your students, a young person who actually went to the White House, mm-hmm. and we'll get to that. But why don't you kind of set the stage and explain what the Telling Room is, where it is, and who participates?
Yeah. So the Telling Room is a nonprofit writing center for kids. And what that means is that we have an actual physical writing center downtown in Portland, right in the Old Port on Commercial Street. It's a big sunny room with couches and beanbags and writing tables. And
well, what part of Commercial Street? I used to have an office down there.
It's we're right across from the Sapporo Sushi Restaurant. We're right there in that little block between Dana and Temple.
I used to have an office at 215 Commercial Street.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
Right there.
Yeah, we probably had the same landlord.
do you have problems with him in the wintertime shoveling in front?
No,
I'm kidding.
Not at all. They're
fine.
No.
So, but when you talk about kids, mm-hmm. what are the age ranges for the programs and for the kids that are part of the program?
Technically, 6 to 18. That's sort of the official limit. Sometimes with some of our English language learner students, we will work with students as long as they are still a senior in high school. And because of those students' history and their educational path, some of them are a little bit older than 18. So they kind of just sneak in.
Got it.
Yeah.
So how do people find the Telling Room? And for young people, 6 to 18, mm-hmm. what happens when they sign up? Is it structured relative to classes, or is it open formatted where in free time people come by and they sit yeah. with yourself or one of the other folks there mm-hmm. and pick up skills in terms of writing?
Yeah. So we have something like 8 different unique programs. So there's all sorts of different ways kids can get involved. About half of the kids that we work with come to us through a partnership with a school. So we might hear from a school in Portland or Falmouth or Lewiston, and they might say, you know, we've got all of these kids in an after-school program who could really use some support. Can you come in for a semester and do a special program with them? Or can you come in during the day, you know, for a few months and do a special program with them? So a lot of kids get no choice about whether they work with us. And then we also have after-school programs and workshops that kids can sign up for. And some of them are actually a competitive application process. All of them are free for kids and their families to participate in. But it's a real mix. And we do everything from kids who just want to learn a little bit more can come to something like our Writer's Block program, which is like free form every Wednesday for a semester. You get free time to write and share with your friends and get a few lessons on different aspects of writing, like character or pacing or something like that, all the way up to our Young Emerging Authors program, which is for kids who want to write their own book, a novel-length book in the course of a year, and they get paired with a writing mentor, and they publish their books, and we have a launch party for them in the community, and then they're sold at local bookstores, and then everything in between. So
interesting. We have Heather Davis here. She's the executive director of the Telling Room here in Portland. For more information, their website is tellingroom.org. So talk a little bit about how the Telling Room first came into existence. Is it nonprofit? And what is the funding, kind of the underlying business platform that it's built on? And mm-hmm. if it's affiliated with any state agencies or any other maybe academic institutions here in Maine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Telling Room was founded in 2004 by 3 writers who wanted to give back to the community. So Mike Paternity and his wife Sarah Corbett and their friend Susan Conley, all really accomplished writers and teachers, they started gathering friends and writers and educators who just wanted to offer programs in the schools. And they would go into art classes during the day to write with students, or they would have, after school drop-in times, and things sort of evolved from there. They published a book in 2006 with a group of 15 students who told their stories of coming to America from different parts of Africa and the Middle East. And they did a big exhibit in the community to celebrate the publication of that book and tell kids stories. And I think that was before I moved here. But my sense is that that's when the community really started to notice, wow, there's this group of writers doing something really interesting and compelling with kids. And things really grew from there. We are a nonprofit. Our funding, it's tricky because we don't charge for most of our programs. So we have very little earned revenue. Mm-hmm. But we have lots of grant support from local foundations, lots of individual donors. We do a gala every year to raise money for the programs, all the usual tricks of the trade. We do have great funding from the Maine Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, which helps out quite a bit.
Interesting. Talk a little bit about, there were a couple of articles recently, mm-hmm. and it has to do, let me make sure that I've got this right, a 19-year-old senior from Deering High School by the name of Ibrahim Shakara was selected to go to the White House to meet Michelle Obama. And it looks like about a dozen National Arts and Humanity Youth Program award winners were invited to the White House. How did that happen? Talk a little bit about the whole experience and how young Ibrahim was selected and what the White House experience was like.
Yeah. So the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities for a long time now has been offering this annual award to youth arts and humanities programs. And it's a very specific type of award. So in order to be considered for it, your program has to happen out of school. So it has to happen, you know, as an enrichment program. It has to have been in existence for 5 years. You have to be able to demonstrate that that the quality of the art and writing being produced in your program is very high caliber, and also show evidence that your program has really great wraparound services or support services. So in our case, the program that won is called Young Writers and Leaders, and it's an after-school program specifically for English language learners in the refugee and immigrant community. They write their stories. They each of them get paired with a mentor who works with them for several months to complete a personal narrative. They tour and present their work in the community, and then they also get financial literacy training, job skills and leadership training, and college prep assistance. So it's a really comprehensive package of services for the kids.
And there was also a grant associated with the White House program of $10,000?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
So did you go down to Washington?
I did, yes.
So how many applications or how many of the students did you submit work for? And then how do you find out something like that? Do you get an email saying, hey, we want to invite you and the student down to the White House? You'll meet the First Lady.
Right. So we sent them information about our program and videos and examples of the kids writing and information about, you know, kind of the details of what happens and who the teachers are and who the kids are. And then you just kind of wait to find out. At some point, they announce the finalists. Every year, there are 50 finalists out of maybe 400 applicants. And even just being named a finalist is a big deal. They put it up on their website, and it's right. A huge, huge feather in your cap as a nonprofit. And then shortly after that, we got a mysterious box from D.C. in the mail, which I didn't even associate with the award. It was very plain. And we opened it. And there was a binder inside with all the information we would need to know to start managing the award and planning the trip to D.C. and a letter of congratulations signed by all the agencies who make the award possible. So that was a fun day. A lot of crying and happy crying in the office.
Happy crying.
Happy crying.
We love happy crying. And so talk a little bit about this student who was selected and his type of writing and the work and then what it was like actually planning the trip and going down to the White House. And there was a picture here in the Press Herald a while back showing First Lady Michelle Obama shaking his hand. And I don't think I could ever see a happier picture of both
the
student Ibrahim Shakara and First Lady Michelle Obama. It's an incredible smile. So it was an incredible event. Talk a little bit about that.
It was an incredible event. So It was very, very, very difficult to choose just one student. We've worked with over 100 students in this program since it started. We narrowed it down by choosing someone who had just participated in the most recent cohort. And, you know, any of the kids would have been fantastic. One reason that we chose Ibrahim was his dedication. He always showed up to every event in a suit and tie. He was always, you know, excited to read and share information about the program in the public. And he was one of the kids who was most transformed by the program. So he had no relationship to writing before he joined. And throughout the program, he learned how the process of writing could help him understand who he is, what his path has been, and what he wants for himself as he goes forward. And that was really important for him. His family had to flee Iraq because of the war, and then they had to flee Cairo because it wasn't an option to stay there any longer. And so he had a lot of thinking to do about who am I and what is my home and what does all of this mean and where am I going? And he was very, writing about all that was really transformational for him. So we went down, we actually were able to take his whole family. So his mother, wow. And two of his brothers and his father, we all traveled together in a little cohort down to DC.
So here are both the student mm-hmm. and his entire family
yeah.
were immigrants coming yeah. to the United States just 4 years ago,
yeah.
2012.
Three, I mean, not even.
Didn't
yeah.
speak English,
yep.
came from Iraq,
mm-hmm.
Turmoil in Iraq, had to flee to Cairo, Egypt, and mm-hmm. that is also going through
yeah.
so many issues in terms of war and
yeah.
violence. They moved to the U.S.,
yeah.
not speaking English.
Yeah.
And in 3 to 4 years,
mm-hmm.
he became proficient enough that he won this award
mm-hmm.
and ended up going to the White House and meeting the First Lady.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a story in itself.
Yeah.
His life story. And I don't know yeah. what he wrote about that was submitted and ultimately won the award, but
mm-hmm.
that had to create so much texture to his life
mm-hmm.
experience
mm-hmm.
and the lens that he saw things.
Yeah.
So you get in the caravan, you get yeah. down there, you obviously have to go through some Secret Service clearance for anyone coming into the White
mm-hmm.
House.
Yep.
And then what was the ceremony and the whole process of being the First Lady like?
It was magic. It was just completely magic. They made us feel so welcome, and they made every aspect of it so special and so exciting. One special thing that happened was that we thought that Ibrahim and I were going to be the only people allowed into the White House. It's actually in a room that's quite small. They don't have room for everybody. And at the last minute, they were able to accommodate his whole family.
Wow.
And Shelley Pingree came down to support us as well and came to the ceremony to be there and to meet his family. And so we all got in, and It was incredible. I mean, there was one moment where I asked Ibrahim if he knew who the man was in this portrait that was next to us. And it was a painting of George Washington, and he didn't know. And so we got to talk about that and who George Washington is. But it was just that was a moment where I realized, you know, how far he had come from growing up in Iraq to being in the White House and sort of finding himself in the middle of you know, the president and first lady's home. And it was incredible. The first lady mentioned Ibrahim specifically in her opening remarks, which was a big distinction because there were 12 other organizations there. And he was, you know, we were beside ourselves. We both cried a little bit. It was really special.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit. We have Heather Davis here. She's the executive director of The Telling Room, a youth program for writing. Would you also say literacy in writing? Is mm-hmm. there also a language component other than just, you know, producing writing?
Basically, the process that every kid goes through, no matter which of our programs they're in, we start out by doing community building because the youth development and the social and emotional well-being piece of our program is just as big as the literacy component. So first, we establish a sense of community. We establish a sense of connection and getting to know one another. And then we spend a lot of time just generating ideas and generating story ideas. And at that point, We pay no attention to the semicolons you were mentioning earlier, you know, no attention to the structure. It's really just, who are you and what's the story that you have to tell? What's right. most important to you? What do you need to write right now? And then once we do that, we get into the drafting process and kids get to work one-on-one with a mentor. That's usually a community volunteer to help them develop the story. And then once we have something to work with, that's when we really get into the true literacy piece and say, okay, here's how revision works. Here's how, you know, a good writer adds detail. Here's how a good writer works with pacing so that, you know, the reader is really drawn in. And we have a director of publications who helps us shape that whole process of what the revision looks like. So they're really getting immersed in the mechanics at that point and making the link between the actual story that they're excited about and improving literacy skills. And then most of the students we work with then get published in a book that they get to share with their school community or on the radio or at a big event in the community. So,
did you get a chance to meet the First Lady also?
Yeah, you can't see it in the picture that you have in that press there, but I'm just to Ibrahim's right. So
wow.
So I got to go up on stage and give her a hug and accept the award and have a very quick little chat.
Did you go in for the hug or did she?
She went in for the hug. In fact, they were very clear. The evening before, there was sort of a rehearsal dinner.
Hug protocol?
There was hug protocol, First Lady hug protocol. Yeah,
wow.
They made us practice with a fake first lady.
That is so funny. I wrote a column a few months ago where I took a position on hugging.
Mm-hmm.
That was,
oh, interesting.
I think it's appropriate when the first lady is doing something like this for the
yeah.
hug. But in some ways, this is, I don't want to divert the conversation, but in some ways, the hugging thing has gotten so complex and out of hand. I never know when you're in the hug zone, when you're
yeah.
hugging, when you're not hugging.
It's tricky.
You, with business colleagues, with friends of my kids' parents, and it's like my wife knows people. She's a big hugger.
Yeah.
And so many times she'll be hugging somebody, and then they look over at me, and they go, I don't know. I don't know if I want to hug you. And then I'm just – and then I kind of like look away or something. But
yeah.
But
I mean, I'm a hugger in general. I would never initiate a hug with the First Lady unless it was clear that was what was wanted. But it's such a heartwarming event. It's one of the most uplifting and positive and happy things you can imagine to be
yeah.
in this room.
And I am an unabashed supporter of our president and the First Lady. But mm-hmm. with any politics aside, the work that they have both done and the work specifically that she has done mm-hmm. in her role as First Lady mm-hmm. with so many youth programs and welcoming so many groups to the White House, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, mm-hmm. healthy eating campaigns,
yeah.
and in this case, arts and humanities. And she has such a powerful aura mm-hmm. and sense of kind of humanity herself
mm-hmm.
that I think it's just so positive for the country, aside from mm-hmm. whoever any listeners fall relative to politics and mm-hmm. party and partisan stuff. I think things like this are important because beyond the politics and the structure of our democracy, a sense of humanity, a sense of empathy, a mm-hmm. sense of humans connecting, and that's what language and writing does, is critical to who we are as people.
Yeah, I mean, and this event is all about celebrating kids reaching their potential. And that's, yeah, it's definitely not a partisan thing.
Yeah. And one of the things that First Lady Michelle Obama had urged in her comments that were reported in the paper was wanting to make sure that we don't lose focus of funding for arts and humanities. And I think there's a broad subject category there, whether it's music, arts, writing, literature. But it feels like those types of programs have been the first to have been cut from budgets as everything has gotten really tight in the last mm-hmm. 10 years. And her quote was, this is First Lady Michelle Obama, quote, "There are millions of kids like these with talent all over the place, and it's hidden and it's untapped, and that's why these programs are so important. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't know that all of that existed without any of these programs, and that would be a shame." And directly, she was referring to the Telling Room and programs like you run.
Mm-hmm.
So hearing the First Lady mm-hmm. speak about something you're connected to,
yeah,
you know, had to be profound.
It's really profound. I mean, as anyone who works for a nonprofit knows. I think one of our fellow awardees said, you know, most of the time you're laboring in obscurity. That was the phrase that she used.
Right.
And it's true. You know, we spent 5 years building this program. Lots of people in Portland and funders have been very supportive. But the day in and day out, it's a tremendous amount of work to partner with the teachers, to meet the kids, to enroll them, to develop the curriculum, to recruit the volunteer mentors, to implement the program. You know, all the things that we do. It's incredibly hard work, and to be recognized at that level, to have someone validate that that matters, that's making a difference, is very, very powerful.
What's the epilogue to Ibrahim's visit relative to school, or where is he taking his interest in writing in the future?
I think for Ibrahim, writing is going to be something that is personally beneficial to him for the rest of his life. We have some alumni engagement programs that we're launching at the Telling Room where he'll be able to come back and continue writing even after he's aged out of our programs, when he's home from college visits and things like that. So, but his focus is pursuing a degree in engineering. Both of his parents were engineers in Iraq, actually.
Wow.
And he and his brother, his older brother, are both interested in pursuing engineering as well. So he's focused on that.
Interesting. You're mm-hmm. listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. One of the intersecting and I think interesting issues that connect with the Telling Room and the work that you're doing is the significant percentage of migrant youth, people mm-hmm. coming here in southern Maine and specifically in Portland, mm-hmm. which is your kind of service area, where language is still being developed. It's not, you know, there's basic language. But there are a couple other references made to some other students. Emmanuel, is it pronounced Muya? Now 21,
mm-hmm.
who came from Congo, mm-hmm. and then other folks who've come from other places around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, there's a lot of discussion about immigrants. There's mm-hmm. a lot of discussion, angry discussion about putting on walls, and clearly the world has gotten a more dangerous place, and I believe we need to be more cognizant. But I don't believe that we should vilify people who come from other places.
Yep.
So talk a little bit about at the Telling Room, where you have folks coming from all different walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Ibrahim, coming 3 years earlier from Iraq through Egypt and then coming to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means culturally
mm-hmm.
for these young people and what it means for the community
mm-hmm.
that, you know, all of your focus is about reading and writing and literacy and communicating. There's no politics. But the reality for some of these immigrants, that's not far from their top of mind.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's in the news. It's
yeah.
in the political realm. And how does that intersect the work that you do? Or do you just not acknowledge it and just focus on writing and literature?
We acknowledge it. It's a little bit of a stealth acknowledgement because, as you say, we're not a political activist group. But part of our mission is to change our community, to make a positive impact on the community. So my hope is that if someone gets to come to a reading or they hear Ibrahim's story on the radio or they pick up his book in the bookstore and they read about this boy who has a loving family, who's a kind person, who was terrorized by war and had to flee his home and never go back again. The hope is that someone who hasn't been through that can start to put themselves in Ibrahim's shoes or in any of our students' shoes and understand how it would feel to have to go through something similar, and then maybe have a moment where they realize this person is not different from me. This person, you know, having this person in my community is an opportunity to, you know, it's something to celebrate. Not to be worried about or not to have a scarcity mentality that there aren't enough resources for people or that.
Yeah, you're really talking about empathy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the kind of the human connectiveness yeah. is when you allow yourself
mm-hmm.
to learn and feel and connect with mm-hmm. someone else's experience, good or bad. And in this case, some of the folks who are immigrants, generally, they've come here in that role because they're coming from something bad, whether it's Syria or Iraq or the Mideast and some places in Central South America. There's bad things happening. And it's not just Portland and it's not just Maine. I think that in the U.S., for many years now, there's been a struggle for people who try to figure out, well, there's social service programs, there's budget crunches, but I don't think we focused enough on the humanity of these actual people because we get caught up on some of the, it's challenging. It's challenging for communities. It's challenging. But, you know, I went to a soccer game, you know, the state finals in Portland. And 95% of the athletes, the student athletes, were immigrants, many from Somalia and from other countries. And it was a great match, great athletes, but it was also, I think, really important. And there was a little, there were some comments afterwards from people who felt like, well, you know, many of those kids were immigrants, but my grandparents both immigrated from Ireland and literally landed in Ellis Island. And anyone who knows anything about American history and the vast majority of everyone here immigrated from somewhere. There's a relatively small percentage of Native Americans. But we've got this weird view now that we're here. And I think we, there are dangers around the world. And ISIS is real and Al-Qaeda is real. And, you know, we're at war. But I think it's wrong to penalize young people, particularly, who have had no role, no voice, and no accountability for what's going on in their countries. And when I see this picture and read this story of Ibrahim Shikara and I see the First Lady, I'm thinking here's a young person who his life, I believe, will be forever changed. And I don't know where he stands relative to citizenship, but if and when he becomes a citizen, goes through that process, you know, an educated, aware, thoughtful, sensitive immigrant is better for the country. Isn't it? I mean, you must see that every day, right? You must see it with young people who they're happy to be here. They're happy being, and I don't know why all the dialogue seems to go in a different direction.
That's why I hope what we do makes some type of difference. I mean, I think if you are trying to understand your stance on the immigration debate, for lack of a better term, if you're just thinking of immigrants as capital I immigrants, this class of people that's other than you and has nothing to do with you, I guess I can see how you can logically work yourself into thinking, you know, we don't have enough resources, it's too dangerous, this just isn't something we should be grappling with. But the reality is, it is incredibly hard to come here as an immigrant or a refugee. I wish people knew more about that process of how long people have to wait, how people grow up in refugee camps, how there's tons of bureaucracy, the application process, the paperwork. It's not just that anyone can just show up here whenever they want. It's actually quite difficult. So, you know, people's fears about safety, I think, could be allayed if they knew more about that. And our students often write really poignantly about that process. So how long did they have to wait? Did one parent come and stay here for a while and save enough money for everyone else to come and to go through the administrative process? You know, you learn about that. And I think learning people's individual stories is just so key to help people understand we are all immigrants. As you said, you know, everyone deserves a shot at living in a safe place with access to healthy water and food and education. And, you know, that anyone could find a stance to deny that to a family after learning about who they are personally. I think that people will be less likely to. So I do hope that we're part of that conversation and part of helping people understand the benefits and the opportunities and, you know, the inherent worth of the people who are coming here and how we can support that as a community.
I agree. In the last minute we have Heather Davis, the executive director of The Telling Room. Anyone interested in information, go to their website, tellingroom.org. Is it available for, is it Portland residents or Southern Maine? So who do you serve? So if there are parents listening that may have kids or grandkids and think, geez, I think it's a good program for, who do you serve? And then talk a little bit about what's next for The Telling Room as you kind of grow and extend your programming.
Yeah. We work with about 3,000 students a year from 60 schools in 30 towns all over southern Maine. And we're willing to go anywhere in the state that we can work it out. We've been as far north as Calais doing poetry programs, and we go all the way down to Wells and Kennebunk and all the way out to the Lakes region and that sort of thing. So we do a lot of our work in Portland because that's where we're physically based, but we are willing to travel and we're willing to host people. So we're always willing to have that conversation. We do a lot of work in Lewiston and Gorham and other towns, you know, all throughout the state. So there's usually a way we can find a way to get involved. In terms of what's next for us, with the Young Writers and Leaders program specifically, that program has a waiting list of over 50 students every year. The demand for it is really huge, and we have folks in the school districts and other towns that are hoping to bring Young Writers and Leaders to them. And so we're working on a plan to raise the money that we need to do that expansion, to hire the teachers that we need to be able to work with these kids. So we're hoping that within the next 3 to 5 years, we can really grow the scope of the program to reach more people. And then organization-wide, we're also working on developing a training program to teach other teachers or people who work with kids in any capacity to do what we do, to do that process of community building and generating a story and publishing it so that they, if we can't get to you, whether you're in Maine or somewhere else, we can teach you how to do what we do in your community. So we'll have news about that coming out soon as well.
Great. And people can get more information at the website?
Yeah, that's right. Our website is the best source of information. You can sign up. We have a monthly newsletter. We're not big emailers, but we do send out an email news blast once a month with all of our updates and upcoming events.
And there's Twitter, @Telling Room. I follow you guys.
Thank you.
Instagram, all of the social media platforms.
Yeah, we're on all of them.
Perfect. Well, I think it's really interesting what you're doing. And, you know, while the event at the White House brought a lot of attention, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I think that I don't think that positive attention should go away as that event kind of goes into the background. I think that you guys deserve a lot of positive focus and attention. And I think writing in all forms is important, but we have issues right now, both here in Maine and in the country and around the world, in that there's not a lot of clear communication between mm-hmm. politicians, yeah. between countries, yep. between leaders, and writing and language skills are really important, not just on the creative side, not just in the, you know, flowery literature or poetry, which has its own artistic merit, mm-hmm. but having an informed, educated, literate electorate and citizenry that can communicate and write is a good thing, regardless of what your view is, because if people can communicate more clearly with more effective tools, then I think that takes away half the problems. So that's my little soapbox. But thank you for coming in, and thank you for all the work that you're doing and the work of your students, and congratulations on the award and the grant that went to the Telling Room.
Thank you.
And would love to have you come back sometime.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
It's been great. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, and we will be back next week.